Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. On May 19th, 1942, a German U-boat set its sights on a freighter in the Gulf of Mexico with 59 people on board. Most of the crew were merchant seamen, but there were also a handful of civilians, including the Downs family, comprised of the parents and two children. When the torpedo struck and the ship exploded, all four members of the family were separated from each other. More than half of the crew and passengers aboard the ship perished, but after 15 hours in the ocean, all of the members of the Downs family survived and were reunited. And all of this happened in the Gulf of Mexico, about 50 miles from New Orleans. Joining me for the rest of the hour today to explore this fascinating bit of overlooked World War II history is Michael Tugayas. He's co-author of the book So Close to Home, The True Story of an American Family's Fight for Survival During World War II. Michael, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you, Mike.
And if you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, give us a call now. The number's 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can find us on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. That's at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So I grew up in Florida, and I like to follow history fairly closely, or at least I'm interested in stuff. But this is all new to me. So where did this come from? Were there lots of German U-boats in the Gulf of Mexico during the war, and I just never heard this before, or what's going on?
There sure were, and So Close to Home focuses on the first one that entered the Gulf, and I was like you. I had no idea U-boats could come all the way from Europe and into the Gulf of Mexico, right to the mouth of the Mississippi River, and head all the way back and not be refueled.
Were they here for reconnaissance, or were they here to blow up ships?
Oh, they were here to blow up ships, and they did a remarkable job. In the first 4 months of this operation, of when they first came over, they sank 200 ships in U.S. waters, and we sank all of one U-boat.
Were they up and down the coast, too? I remember the closest I could get to this in my memory is Ernest Hemingway. The story is that he re-outfitted his Pilar.
He did.
So that's sort of – this is all part of that same story.
Yeah, they were up and down the East Coast, but then in May of 1942, the first one commanded by Eric Vardaman, he was only 29 years old, entered the Gulf of Mexico. And his mission was to sink as much tonnage as possible. It didn't even have to be a U.S. warship or even a tanker, any U.S. ships. And he was remarkably successful.
Hmm. So were ships that were, going through Gulf waters mindful of this and trying to protect themselves from this, or were they just sitting, ducks?
Well, later they were mindful of it, but because he was the first.
This was...
Yeah, these poor early ships that were attacked were not quite aware of it, and particularly the ship that the Downs were on, that family, that was called the Heredia. It was owned by United Fruit, was coming back from South America, and the family wanted to get home.
It had bananas on it?
It had bananas, which is never a good thing on a boat. That's bad luck. I'm a fisherman, and I always look around at my friends going, "You didn't bring a banana, did you?"
How did you come across this story?
I was speaking at John Hancock doing a motivational talk, and the lead attorney said, "I have someone I want you to meet." And he was a fisherman, so we all went out fishing, and through him, this gentleman at John Hancock, I met Sonny Downs, who was 8 years old.
He was the kid that in this story.
He's kind of the lead character, really, in the So Close to Home. And Sonny, of course, at the time when I met him, was probably 80 years old and just was blown away by his story and the detail and some of the archival research he had done. And so I contacted co-author Allison O'Leary, who was a reporter and journalist for the Boston Globe, and I said, "You got to meet this guy. This is an incredible story. I had no idea U-boats were over by the Mississippi River."
So besides his firsthand account, what other sources did you have for the research to put this story together?
Well, we had U.S. Navy documents, and we had interviews with survivors. But most importantly were his other family members. For example, his mother, Ina, and we didn't know this till we were well into the research, had left an audio recording of what happened to her in the ocean.
Wow.
And the sharks and the works. And Sonny didn't even know this was out there. We found it through a distant niece.
And you also had the diary of the U-boat captain. Is that correct?
That was a turning point, and I did cartwheels when we found that. Allison located that at the National Archives.
That must have been like finding, you know, that was your unicorn for this story, right?
It really was, and it changed the course of the book because now, rather than only focusing on this survival at sea story, I've done seven like that. Now we could expand it and give both perspectives because we had his diary, what he was thinking, feeling, his decisions, why he did what he did. And then we followed him throughout the course of the book right up to his death. It was one of the only U-boat commanders that we know his last words. Usually they go to the bottom of the ocean and that's it.
What were his last words?
Let me go, because he was in the ocean when he got blasted on the U-boat. He was in the conning tower, ended up in the ocean. Two of his men were keeping his head above water. He was injured. He didn't want them to die as well. He said, let me go, and that was the last he was ever seen.
Wow. I'm talking with Michael Tagias. He's co-author of the book So Close to Home, The True Story of an American Family's Fight for Survival During World War II. It follows a family that was in a freighter that was sunk by a German sub in the Gulf of Mexico during the war. He'll be giving a talk tomorrow morning at 10. It's at the South Florida Water Management District office in Fort Myers that's right next to the Edison Ford Estates. The Edison Ford Estates is presenting the talk. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-428-8255. GCU Talk. So what's the short version of this story? Because I don't want to preempt your talk tomorrow, but kind of what happened, what unfolded with this family? What were the key ingredients to this story?
Well, and tomorrow I will use slides.
Be showing pictures and
from the actual.
Is there any of the audio of the mom? Are you going to play any of that?
Not. I'll recite a few of her lines. The long and the short of it is when the torpedoes hit, the family's together in their berth and the water's pouring in and they all try to run up to the lifeboats. But the second torpedo blows them all apart. So you have – for them, it's terrible. Each one's on their own. For an author, it's incredible because now I've got four survival stories.
Yeah, you've got four scenes happening.
Exactly. And It's a miracle ending that all four of them made it, and each one had a stroke of luck that got them through it.
Like what? Can you give some little examples of the pivot points?
Yeah, I'll give an example. Ina sees a sailor after she's been in the water for several hours suffering from hypothermia. She sees two sailors on a piece of wood that came from the ship, and she goes over there, and one of the sailors is naked, maybe he was sleeping that way or taking a shower when the torpedoes hit or whatever. And he goes off. He doesn't want her to see him. And she goes,
wow, modesty in the midst of disaster.
Well, she says basically what you just said. She goes, this is no time to be modest. Get back up here. You'll freeze to death. And he goes, no, ma'am. And after 2 hours and she sees he's turning blue, she says, if you don't get up here, you're forcing me to leave. So get up here, and figures that'll call his bluff. Well, he refuses, so she leaves on her own. Who would leave, you know, this piece of flotation in the ocean and other people?
Right.
She leaves on her own and is circled by sharks, and she claims what saved her was at the last minute she put on a big, heavy wool coat so that when the first shark came in, it didn't feel flesh, it felt wool. And she credits that for saving her life.
How long were they all in the water for?
From 18 to 20 hours approximately.
And they were all found separately, or did some of them sort of glom together at some point during this story?
Sonny and his dad eventually were able to reunite, and that's quite a story because so did the captain with Sonny and the dad. And the captain and Sonny's dad do not see eye to eye on how to conduct this survival.
Oh, okay. So there was
– it almost comes to blows. So, they're lucky they made it.
Are you still in touch with Sonny?
Yes. Oh, yeah. In fact, a couple times he's even spoken with us. He lives up in Quincy, Massachusetts.
Huh. Any chance there's a movie in this? This seems like this has the potential for, you know, it's got all the plot elements, right?
I got lucky with one of my books called The Finest Hours, which is now a Disney movie with Chris Pine and Casey Affleck. So, you know, lightning can hit twice, but the movie business is the stars have to align. That's what I've learned.
You had to find this story. You know, you stumbled across it. Was there press on it at the time? It seems like this is the kind of thing that would make whatever the local paper was in 1942 would probably have told this story, I would think.
Yes, the Times-Picayune in New Orleans interviewed the Downs family, other survivors, and we have a beautiful picture of the family right after they've been rescued.
Which we have on our website, thanks to you.
Yep, and they've been reunited. They can't believe they're all alive.
Was there any part of this story that surprised you the most that you uncovered?
How dedicated Erich Vardaman in
the German captain
were. Yes, and I actually came to respect him, and some people say, oh, you can't do that with this Nazi. I'm like, well, he wasn't a Nazi. He wasn't a member of the Nazi party. He was 29 years old, serving his country, and he kept going back out knowing eventually he wasn't going to return because our technology was catching up with the U-boats.
Hmm. You co-authored this with Allison O'Leary.
Yes.
Is that someone you've worked with before, or how did that collaboration come about?
We had worked a couple times in the past, so I knew she was the one to work with, just a great investigative journalist. And that's what we needed on this.
Hmm. What were your primary sources? I mean, it seems like
the National Archives.
Yeah, what is the world of an investigative journalist when it comes to a story like this? There seems like there's lots of places to look these days, right?
Yeah, and thank God for the internet because, you know, there's just so much information. And, you know, our big break was using the internet to find what we consider the U-boat expert because we were not. And he runs the website uboatarchives.net. And without him, I don't know if we could have done the book because he would proofread chapters as we went along. For example, you know, one thing that he pointed out, I said, you know, Sonny could see the U-boat and see everything that was happening because the U-boat surfaced and shined a spotlight. And he said, are you sure about that? That would almost never happen because the U-boat would be bombed when our planes come out.
Mm-hmm.
And Allison and I looked through all the different survivors' testimonies, and they all said the same thing. The U-boat was there with the spotlight. So the thinking was because it was the first one and they didn't have much respect for our U-boat hunting skills that he risked coming up to see the ship sink.
How much is known about the other boats that were sunk or damaged by this same U-boat?
Okay. Quite a bit there, and we document those in the book. We don't just talk about the ship Sonny was on. We talk about as they come by the Straits of Florida, the U-boat commander sees all the lights on in Miami, and he can't believe it. He says, lights on as if in peacetime in his war diary, that can silhouette a ship. And so that's where they begin their happy hunting, as they called it. So he sank 10 ships and damaged 3 more.
Wow. I had no idea. This is all news to me. Okay, so we're just a few minutes toward the end of the hour here, but before we go, let's pivot to your new book, Above and Beyond. Tell us about this just a little bit.
This is about a little-known story during the Cuban Missile Crisis. One of our U-2 spy plane pilots over Cuba, right after we discovered the missiles, was shot down and Major Rudy Anderson was killed. So that was the impetus to do the book because I said, I didn't know that. I thought the Cuban Missile Crisis ended without a single combat death. Well, Rudy Anderson was the exception. So started digging into some other little known facts of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in the book, we've got 4 that had us on the brink of nuclear war that most people don't know about. And a big contributor to the book is a gentleman who lives in Venice, Florida. He's 86 years old. His Brigadier General Jerry McElmoyle, back at the time, was a U-2 pilot flying over Cuba, was shot at by 2 surface-to-air missiles, and it was covered up from President Kennedy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they didn't want Kennedy to suspend the U-2 flights, they being the military, we think. And 2 days later, of course, that's when Rudy Anderson is shot down from the sky. So I often wondered, you know, maybe if they didn't cover up what happened to Jerry, maybe Jerry Anderson might not have flown and lived.
You know, we run a show on the weekends called Snap Judgment, which has storytelling elements to it. And there was – yesterday's episode was – there was a story of a guy who was sent in to Cuba on a mission during that time frame where they were going to try to bomb some of the missile silos. His job was to go there and light it up so they can find it. The whole thing ended up being aborted, but it was the most fascinating. I'll send you a link to it.
I would love another bit
of history that I didn't know about. How do you come up with these ideas? I mean, is it just generally stumbling across something when you're fishing?
That helps. And whenever I ask myself, wow, I didn't know that, and I'm like you, a history buff, I figure other people didn't, and that's when I start to dig in. And that's what happened with the Finest Hours. That's about the greatest Coast Guard rescue in history. Happened in my own backyard. I didn't even know about it. So I follow that. So with the Above and Beyond, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, I'll be giving a slide presentation on that on February 18th. So February 18th. At the Boca Grande Community Center.
Gotcha. And that book is out now?
Yes. Yep. That book came out. We had a nice coverage in the Wall Street Journal. And I dedicated the book to Jerry McElmoyle up there in Venice.
And he's still around?
He's around and doing just fine.
Jerry, if you're listening, we have to get you on this show. So what are you working on now? How far out do you – I mean, it seems like – You authors probably are constantly churning something for 3 years from now or something like that.
That is all true. I'm working with publisher Henry Holt, taking some of these adult books and turning them to middle reader books, so age 9 to 14. And we've done two so far. One is called A Storm Too Soon, about an incredible rescue. Aviation rescue with the rescue swimmer in 80-foot seas. So imagine dropping this poor rescue swimmer into that. And my mission now is to do more of those because I think that young people don't read enough, and in particular young males. And I read all the time around the clock, and it's really served me well. And I want to get the kids reading again, and so my style with adult books is to make them fast-paced, and my style with the young adult ones is to make them even faster-paced.
Do you have a new editor for this project that is helping you think like a middle schooler?
She says I don't need much help. she's a wonderful editor. She has her own imprint at Holt, and it's called Christy Ottaviano Books. So we're doing a whole series, and it's been a great collaboration.
Okay. And before we run out of time, just one more time, you're going to be where tomorrow?
So tomorrow at the Edison Ford Estates, actually in the building next door at the Water Management building. And that's on, is it McGregor Ave?
McGregor Boulevard. Yep, right. It's 2130, I believe. But it's just adjacent to the Edison Ford Estate.
And it's a morning program. So it's 10 a.m. It's free, open to the public. So I hope we get a great crowd. I brought all 30 of my titles. So I'll be doing a book signing at the end. And again, it's an exciting slide presentation. I'm not going to talk too much about myself. I want to make it be like the audience is watching a movie.
Awesome. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Michael Tagais, co-author of the book So Close to Home, The True Story of an American Family's Fight for Survival During World War II. Michael, thank you for coming in and sharing that with us.
Thank you, Mike.
He will be giving the presentation tomorrow at 10 at the South Florida Water Management District office on McGregor Boulevard in Fort Myers next to the Edison Ford Estates. And thanks to our earlier guests during our segment about handling issues surrounding addiction during the holiday season, Brenda Iliff from Hazelden Betty Ford Facility in Naples, and Rosemary Beauvais from Salus Care in Fort Myers. Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.